Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Kate Loving and the Collective Wisdom. My name is Kate Loving Schenck of katelovingschenck.com and author of the Prayer Prescription Series, and I host the show. My guest this evening is Captain Dan Willis, author of Bulletproof Spirit, the first responder's essential resource for protecting and healing mind and heart. Please join me in welcoming Captain Dan Willis. Hello, Dan.
Hi, Kate. Thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to hear your voice, and I certainly loved your book. And I've been blogging about it kind of regularly, and people have responded favorably to, you know, what I've been writing about. So my first question basically is, and it's really interesting to me, you know, how first responders have always been seen as heroes, and that is exactly what they are. But it seems like society has sort of whitewashed the other side of it, which is that they're also wounded by post-traumatic stress, and that's because of their experiences of seeing some very brutal things, catalyst for you to write your book.
Well, most of my career, I've been a police officer now for 25 years, has been in investigations and working homicide cases, some cold case homicides that took over 5 years to work and solve, a lot of crimes of violence. And one of the most disturbing cases I worked was a person who was taken about 120 miles away from my city and murdered, had his head and hands cut off. And we never did find his head and hands. And it was a case that was one of those that took 5 years to solve. But in dealing with that case, I became completely immersed in this world of drug dealers and pimps and prostitutes, and dealing with these people and talking to them day in and day out for that period of time. And the nature of such a senseless and violent crime really did weigh me down and poison my spirit. And I noticed kind of in the midst of that investigation that I was losing all feeling. I really didn't have any feeling or connection to anybody or anything. The only thing I was concerned about was working the case. And I became very disconnected to my wife, to my stepdaughters. I didn't feel engaged or connected with them. And I realized that, wow, this is really not a good place to be. And I really needed to take a hard look at myself and how the job was negatively affecting me.
Yeah, that is interesting because becoming so immersed in a case like that, in so many cases, after a while, and as a nurse, I see it too, where there's an impersonal thing that happens, almost an objective thing, where people kind of make fun of people, they kind of pigeonhole them, and you point out in your book that over 90% of people are good people. But the kind of work that you in particular do and so many other first responders is that they see kind of like the gory sides of life, and you forget that people are virtually good. I mean, most people are good. What do you have to say about that?
That's absolutely correct, Kate. Probably about 2% of the population are the criminals. And, you know, that's what the first responders deal with day in and day out constantly, 12-hour shifts, day and night. And over time, that seems to be our view of everyone, that they're a criminal, or we suspect that they're a criminal or up to no good. And eventually we start treating our loved ones like that. We question them. We're suspicious of everything. We're very, very cynical. We start treating our kids like they're a suspect. And, of course, that's very devastating to our personal relationships and the quality of our life. And it's, you know, one of the emphases that first responders need to realize is the vast, vast majority, just like you said, are good, honest, decent people. And when we walk away from our job at the end of our shift, we really need to focus on tuning into our new role as, okay, I'm a father now, or I'm a mother, I'm a husband or a wife, and focus in on that role and remain engaged and committed and involved with that role, as opposed to being completely so identified with your first responder job.
Yes, so you would recommend a spiritual practice to help people to make that distinction, and to have a faith in the higher power or the universal spirit or God, or however people need to define that. Would you say that that's the solution to being able to deal long term with the kinds of job that you have been doing?
Well, for many people, it is. For me, the single most important thing that has enabled me to survive 25 years of law enforcement has been my own personal spiritual journey and connection with God. And if that's not something that resonates with somebody, there's many, many, many other things I describe in the book: proactive wellness, emotional survival strategies that you can do that's going to help protect and nurture and heal your spirit. But if you happen to be a person of faith, depending upon that, relying on that, calling upon that source of infinite hope that gives you a sense of purpose in our work. I mean, first responders are the only ones that are out there that protect and give life to people. I mean, in a way, we are kind of doing God's work in protecting people and standing up to evil. So being able to be connected to that source will help us to be able to serve with compassion. It will help us process the stress and overcome trauma, because it's almost, in a sense, working in partnership with the higher source that connects all life and the purpose of our work.
How did you come to make that connection when you yourself were feeling so disconnected?
It's something that has always been a part of my nature, and maybe during that period it was beginning to get a little covered up and mm-hmm. forgotten, in a sense, as I was being so focused on working that case and so many others. But, you know, I credit my mom, who, when I was a little boy, 7, 8 years old, she would read me bedtime stories every night about famous people who devoted their lives to making the world a better place. And she would always tell me that, you know, you've been blessed by God with a healthy mind and body, and you have a responsibility when you grow up to do something with your life that's going to make a positive impact on others.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since I was a little kid, I wanted to be a police officer. And mm-hmm. I was raised with this connection of the spiritual life, of really being the essence of who we are and what we do. So that just has always been a natural part of how I perceive the world and go about my work, working in partnership with this higher source for good. And other people who aren't necessarily people of faith, if they focus on their spirit, because everyone will say, hey, we're more than just a mind and a body. We also have a spirit. Our spirit is what motivates us. It's our resiliency to overcome stress and trauma. It's our inner hope, our beliefs and character. I mean, everyone has a spirit, and that's what makes us human. And mm-hmm. first responders tend to ignore their spirit as they go about their jobs, and over time it becomes very toxic from what we see. So the book really helps focus upon your inner self and your spirit so you can help protect and nurture and heal it.
Yes, I think I read in your book about taking care of your soul, and when people forget to do that, that's when, well, there's a high rate of suicide in your profession, and also with the soldiers coming home, because soldiers are also seen as first responders, huge amongst that group and amongst police officers.
Oh, it's just terrible statistics.
Yes.
It's horrible. We're losing 21 military veterans every single day and one active duty soldier every day to suicide. And suicide is the number one cause of death for police officers every single year in the United States. And the reason why the spirit is so essential is because it's the foundation of our mental and physical and emotional health and well-being. And when you neglect your spirit, you're going to become a victim of your profession. There's no way to deal with all the negativity and the evil and the suffering that we deal with without doing something to breathe life into your spirit. Otherwise, the job is going to deplete it.
Exactly. And obviously, the 2% that you mentioned earlier who are lost and possibly even evil, wonder why, what has happened in their lives that they can't, you know, come back. I guess some criminals do come back, but, and we have to give them a chance to come back, don't get me wrong, but have you ever walked a mile in their shoes to try to figure out why they do what they do?
It's, your comment about them coming back, some of the most satisfying experiences of my career have been, I've had a couple times when people have come in to the police department, ask for me, and they thank me. You know, they're out of jail, they're out of prison, and they thank me for arresting them because that was the one thing that got them to turn their life around. And so people certainly can change and make become something positive out there in society. But you know, drug use and how people are raised with maybe one parent, if you're lucky. I think it is one of the main causes of why people grow up very, very selfish, very disconnected, without any real moral upbringing of what's right and wrong and being positive and looking towards your future. I mean, there's so many young people that they just don't have any sense of their future. And it just seems like they are so narcissistic, they don't really care about anyone or anything. And it's got to be the impact of being raised so many times without both parents being there, providing that example of good, honest, decent, hardworking people that's instilling those morals that can help someone to be a positive member of society.
Yeah, but then you see people who actually are raised that way, the way that you just described, and they're extremely resilient, and they are basically the definition of resilience is embodied in some of the way these people have overcome their circumstances, which makes you think, well, there really is no excuse for people to act that way, because you know what I'm saying, you know.
Right. There's not really an excuse. And I think at some point as we're growing up and maturing, you know, people make a decision of, am I going to use what has happened to me as an excuse to act however I want to and make myself a victim and go out there and victimize other people? Or am I going to use what's happened to me as stepping stones, as character stepping stones, and make something out of myself and be even more of a valuable, valued, appreciated, positive member of society because of what I've experienced. And, you know, some people choose one way and some people choose the other. And unfortunately, all we see are the ones that choose the other that we have to deal with day in and day out.
Yeah, that's tough. That's really tough. Tell us about the wellness programs that really are so vital to helping the first responder get over quicker, you know, to heal quicker from some of the things that happened to them.
Well, here at my agency, we've had what we call a peer support team for about the last 18 years or so. And there's similar agencies out there that have similar teams, but their whole function is really set up to help an employee once something tragic happens to them. Once they've had a fatal shooting, a critical incident, once they're having problems at work, they're going through a divorce or whatever, then the peer support team is there to offer a trusted and confidential resource for the person to listen to help out and assist in any way that they can. What we kind of did, what was new, was instead of just relying on being reactive, you know, once someone is having problems, what can we do on the proactive side? And that was the emphasis of writing Bulletproof Spirit, is to provide the proactive things on the front end that we can teach our officers, our employees, what they can do toward working towards their own wellness and emotional survival. So hopefully they won't need a peer support person because they're able to deal with things more effectively and to process the trauma and the stress. So part mm-hmm. of that proactive wellness program has involved many, many things here at our agency. We have a department wellness library where over the last 3 years we've had over 150 books checked out by the cops and the dispatchers. We go to lineup trainings and we meet with all the employees to provide emotional survival training and resources and information. We try to become very, very involved in the community because that helps to counteract all the negativity and darkness that we see, to go out and actually do things that are positive and proactive. So for the last many, many years, we adopt multiple families over the Christmas time to provide presents and food for people who are in need. There's this one elderly couple that we've recently adopted who, I don't even know how they could even live in their house. It was just so degraded and filthy. And we went in there and cleaned it all up. We helped them pay their rent. We took care of the house. We painted it. We've done all kinds of stuff. And that's the kind of stuff that we want to teach, that you want to do. And when you retire, you want to be able to look back on your career and feel good about all those good things that you did to make a positive impact, as opposed to trying to forget all the bad.
Yeah, that's a great story about taking care of those wonderful people who must have believed that they were forsaken, that nobody cared about them, and to have what you all did for them happen to them must have felt like a major miracle. I mean,
yes,
it was.
This older couple, and the husband has since died, and we still, you know, look in on the widow and help take care of her. We bought them food numerous times, have done all kinds of things. And before the husband died, he looked at me and he was trying to thank me, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, "You know, I didn't think anyone would ever give a damn about us." And it was just so touching to be able to feel and be connected with someone who appreciated what we were able to do for them. I mean, first responders are going to have thousands and thousands of people throughout their career, and we have so many opportunities to do so much good out there that we really have to remember. That's the real reason why we wanted to be first responders in the first place, was to be able to be out there and help people.
Oh, that's lovely, isn't it? And it's so true. Now, Dan, I can sort of feel people wondering, where can they get your book, and what is the name of your website?
The name of the website is firstresponderwellness.com, and from there they can get all the information about the book, and on the front page there's links to where they can purchase it on Amazon or download it. So firstresponderwellness.com is the easiest way to get the information.
That's great. Thank you. I have a new respect for chaplains as first responders from reading your book, because, you know, as you had pointed out in your book, there's a difference between chaplains and clergy. Explain how that works.
Yes, chaplains are kind of the unnoticed and not very much talked about, but they offer such a tremendous service and resource to our first responders. I mean, they traditionally have been there for the military and for the police officers, but more and more they're being used in hospitals for the nurses, for the paramedics, and for other first responders that are really suffering from their job. And the great thing about chaplains are they are solely there. They come into your culture, into your agency, solely to serve your needs and to help and assist you in any way possible. They're not there, and in fact, they're prevented from talking on their own about faith or trying to, convert or bring you over to their particular church. If you talk about it yourself and start asking questions, then obviously they can begin a discussion with you. But They are solely there to help the officer, and we've used our chaplain to talk to family members who've just lost a loved one to help bring them some peace. Our officers use them for free marriage counseling because they'll ride with the officers for 10 or 12 hours during a shift, and they'll talk to them about issues with their marriage or with their kids or any problems that they're having. I mean, chaplains, all they do is they're clergy, and so they deal with people's problems day in and day out. So they have a lot of great experience, and everything that you tell a chaplain is legally confidential. A chief of police can never order a chaplain to tell him what your discussions were. So it's this protected, confidential, safe resource of someone who just cares about you and how you are doing and how you're getting by and what ways can they help. So they really are a great resource. They're very, very committed, very, very loyal, and compassionate people who volunteer to become chaplains to help out the first responders. I have a tremendous respect for them myself. They've been a great, great resource for our agency, and I see all the great and good work they do. I just wish more people would utilize them and see what a great resource they actually are.
Have you known any police officers to become chaplains?
I have not. I have known a chaplain who's been one for probably almost 18 years now with a couple of police departments here in our county. But I don't personally know of someone who's been a police officer and then became a chaplain. I'm sure there are, and those would be the best of yet. Because one of the hardest things to come into, for example, a police culture is to be accepted. I mean, we are so cynical and distrusting and suspicious of everybody. To have someone come in who we know, okay, this is a member of the clergy to begin with, and now he's going to ride in your office, your car, for the next 12 hours, they can get really standoffish. But once the officers accept them, and then the word gets out of all they do is just care totally about you and your well-being and your emotional survival, then they really get accepted. I mean, our chaplain has even gone to the home of injured officers and done their laundry, has brought them dinner. I mean, we use her for everything imaginable, and she's just a tremendous, tremendous resource.
It's lovely. I just love it. I have a question I've been thinking about asking you. The latest situation in Ferguson, Missouri, and the situation with the police shooting the one police officer shooting Michael Brown, and it was one of those things that has, I think, there's been a lot of situations like that lately, and I'm wondering what I notice is that people have a more of a distrust towards the police as a result of these incidences. Have you given that any thought as to, well, how can that kind of situation be healed is my main interest. And asking that.
Well, one thing that I think people don't really understand is, I mean, they know that the Brown family has suffered a tragedy. The community has suffered a tragedy, but it's also a tragedy for the police department. And if you can imagine just the fear of an officer who might be standing in a line in front of a crowd who's rioting or about to riot, who's throwing things at them, who wants to hurt them, some who want to kill them, and you're there to try and keep the peace and protect people in a group who hate you and despise you. And these cops are out there every day and every night risking their lives to protect that community, to protect and serve them as best as they're able while they're being hated and defiled and victimized. And the fear just must be overwhelming at times. And if I really feel for the Ferguson department, because if they don't really focus on the wellness of their officers and doing those things that's going to help protect and nurture their spirit through this crisis, they're likely to lose a number of officers, and that would just add to the whole tragedy the entire situation.
Well, have you been in touch with that department in any way, or people that you know? I mean, has there been an outreach to the officers themselves in this situation?
Not that I personally know of, but what typically happens when agencies are experiencing a similar type of situation is they will reach out, and there are people who have been in the field of counseling and helping first responders who departments like that will often reach out and have them come in and provide some type of training and emotional survival, wellness, and or ways for them to what they call critical incident stress management debriefing, where officers who are part of that critical incident or others in the rioting get together with a counselor, with a police psychologist, with their peer support team, and discuss everything that they've been going through, how they're going to move forward and how they're going to try to positively and constructively process what they have experienced and move on. So those things can be very, very helpful and are much needed in Ferguson and other places.
Well, exactly. And something happened recently in our community where, and I live in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where there was an officer shot a pit bull. And it was, so many people thought it was unnecessary, but there was a lot of chaos surrounding the incident. So say what I noticed that the police officers were going through the streets and talking to everybody there who was there, and they were trying to create a bridge of understanding between what had happened and people's perceptions and giving the impression that the police officers cared about what had happened. And I would think it would be very frustrating for the police officers in Ferguson because they can't get any kind of sympathy, you know, for their actions. And they can't, they probably, and the national press has, well, but not so much the national press, but certain elements of the press have really kind of demonized that department and many departments across the country for focusing in on African Americans and people of color and shooting them and focusing in on them as opposed to the white privileged folks, basically. And, there is a certain amount of truth to that.
And what happens, the story you're telling me about the pit bull, that's a great story of the officers trying to reach out and connect and reconnect and kind of explain and be part of the community. Now, in something like Ferguson, they can't really do that. There's just so much hate and violence expressed towards officers. They can't go out there to try to explain and connect with the community that they're devoted to serve. So what typically happens is they become very defensive and draw with inside, and it becomes almost us against them, to where you have this fortress mentality. And that just really tends to make things worse. There's got to be some way to have some effective reach out to some of the leaders in the community to where the officers can start connecting and relating to the community that they serve.
I agree, and it makes me feel very bad for them. And I know that they can't, and I wonder if they have a wellness program. And I wonder if there will be a higher incidence of suicide in that department. And there has to be a certain amount of compassion for everybody involved in these situations, not just the so-called victims. And the whole idea that people are victims, to me, seems to create that duality between people where they can't heal what needs to be healed. And the whole thing with what I was just describing in our community where the police officers were doing an outreach like that, I kind of doubt whether they would get very far doing that in Ferguson. And I guess unless, I don't know what would happen, but if the police officer who shot Michael Brown would step down, I guess that could be something that would help, but I'm not sure if it would really help.
Well,
it hasn't happened yet. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, is that I don't know. The public doesn't know. I mean, no one really knows what happened except the investigators, and they don't know because the investigation is really still ongoing.
Yeah.
When that incident happened, you had this influx of the media and everyone else demanding that things happen. And there might very well be a prosecution. You know, if the facts warrant it, then absolutely there should be. But if they don't, we don't prosecute people to make others feel good. I mean, there has to be, I mean, no officer wakes up and says, today I'm going to go out and kill somebody. That doesn't happen. That officer was out doing his job. Something happened. Something brought those two together. There was some type of altercation, and now there's a man dead. And we're still, speaking of Ferguson, Ferguson is still trying to investigate and determine exactly what happened. And when you kind of have this pressure to do something, because then that will be justice, when you don't even know what justice is, you don't know what happened yet.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
The process, there's a process in place. The process can't be sped up. It has to be allowed to, in order for people to trust it, it has to be allowed its full course. And eventually, I mean, juries are usually really good at getting it right. And eventually, the truth of what exactly happened will come out. And whatever that is, both sides and the whole community have to find a way to heal and move on.
Yes, and there's a certain amount of racism that has emanated from these situations. And that America has a lot of problems with racism, and this kind of situation certainly doesn't help. It has inflamed racism. So, and people are paranoid. They're not. It would be so wonderful if there could be the community coming together with the police, but I imagine that it must be real hell over there. That's all I can say. I feel sorry for them all.
I would agree, and again, I would just reemphasize the fear. I mean, think of you're going out there, you kiss your wife goodbye, you have no idea whether you're going to see her that night, and you're going out there in the community knowing how hated you are, just because you're wearing a badge. You weren't involved in the incident or anything else, and you're going out there, you don't know if you're going to be assaulted, you don't know if you're going to be shot at, and you're out there to try to help and protect those people, everyone, the whole community. And just the fear has got to be really just crippling, and the lack of support. And because, you know, whatever happens to the officer, the justice system will do whatever, I have total faith, will do whatever is right. But you still have the entire police department and a community that are together, one community, and have to find some way to get past all of the distrust and the misperceptions of each other, so the community can be better policed and for the community to be safer.
Yes, as one police officer pointed out to me after the shooting of the Pitbull, that their main job is to protect the safety of the citizens. And that is, I believe, what you were just saying, and it must be what most that police officers really are. That's their job, to protect the safety of the citizenry of wherever it is that they are policing. And there's so much that can happen. When I read your book, I see that certain incidences can occur over, you know, many, many things can happen, but one thing happens that is forever embedded in the brain of the person who's experienced it, and it really causes post-traumatic stress. Let's talk a little bit about the post-traumatic stress of, well, since you're a police officer, of police officers, and of course of military personnel. The post-traumatic stress is huge in your profession.
It is really, really very, very disheartening, Kate. I mean, PTSD is just a tragedy amongst all the first responders. Just in police officers, there's an estimated 120,000 police officers going to work every single day with PTSD, not really knowing what they have. A lot of it is undiagnosed, but they have these intense feelings of fear, of acute anxiety, anxiety attacks where all of a sudden there is difficulty breathing, where they can't sleep at all at night. They have terrible nightmares and depression, and it just goes on and on and on. And what people, mm-hmm. I think, need to realize is that post-traumatic stress disorder really isn't a disorder. It's an injury. It's an injury to your brain's ability to process a critical, stressful event. Because as we're going about our day's activities, our brain is just naturally processing everything, and all of a sudden this critical incident happens, it actually injures your mind's ability to deal with that and to process that. And that's why people with PTSD describe it as a video loop in their head of playing the incident over and over and over again. And every time it's being played in their mind, they're feeling those intense feelings of fear of them about to die or whatever the critical incident was. And it is just so debilitating. But the good news is that there are really effective treatments for PTSD. One of the most effective I've heard of is called EMDR. And basically it's a process where a psychologist will have you relive that experience while they're shining a light in your eyes. And through that process, and they're moving your eyes back and forth through the light, somehow through that process, it enables your mind to heal, to process that event and put it in its proper perspective so the person can move on. Now, they'll always remember the incident. It's just that when they remember it, it won't be crippling. And we have, if I have time, I'll tell you a real quick story. There's an officer involved in a fatal shooting, and he was fine for several weeks. And then one day he came home, and all of a sudden his five-year-old boy came running up to him, and he saw blood running down his kid's face, phantom blood. And at dinner, he would see blood in the food while he was trying to eat his meal. And he'd see blood pooling around his wife's head when he watched her sleep at night. So, and his officer thought he was losing his mind. And the more he tried not to think about that and kind of shake it off, the more intense these images kept coming back. And he didn't know what to do. And somebody on his peer support team told him about EMDR, and he went and saw the police psychologist. And he only had to go one time, and he said it was life-changing. He never again saw phantom blood. And just imagine what that officer, what might have happened to him as that continued over the years with him trying to deal with that.
Well, what's beautiful is that he asked for help. And that is what so many people do not do. And that's where they get into trouble.
If for some reason, I mean, we're first responders and we think we can take care of everything, but you know, it the weakness is really not asking for help so you can be healthy and well for your loved ones. That's the real weakness. There is help that's available out there. There's so many things that you can do that I describe in Bulletproof Spirit that are proactive, that are going to heal and help nurture and protect your spirit. So hopefully you'll be better able to process a critical incident and all the stress of your job. And there's just so much to do that's proactive and positive that people really need to take it seriously, their emotional well-being and their emotional survival. And they'll be able to survive like I have for almost 26 years and hopefully make it to retirement proud of all the lives I've been able to save and to help and positively affect.
Well, the beautiful thing is that your book should really help people to put a lot of things into perspective and ask for help when it's necessary to ask for help and to implement wellness programs in their place of work and to have suicide prevention in place, because that is huge, and to have other people understand the warning signs of suicide and to have people be aware of the warning signs of suicide within themselves and not to be drawn to killing themselves, which is what happens. You know, there's this irresistible pull to kill themselves. They can't help it. It's
right.
I've just been reading about it. It's not just something that people, when they start to get the idea that they want to commit suicide, nothing can really stop it. It's bizarre.
And but, a lot of, I believe a lot of that is so much of a first responder's job is a sense of helplessness. Because just so often we're not able to save a child. We're not able to revive the person. We're not able to catch the criminal before he ends up raping or robbing or killing somebody else again. And a lot of times we just get overwhelmed with the sense of being helpless. And if you're not doing anything to help protect and nurture your spirit, that helpless and hopeless feeling kind of feeds into all of the adverse effects of the job, which only heightens the depression and all the other negative effects, which could ultimately lead to someone taking that ultimate choice because they just feel they are really hopeless and helpless.
Yes, and as a nurse, we think our ultimate job is to save lives, which of course it is. But when people die, we feel like we failed somehow. And that is erroneous. I mean, people do die. it's funny because we think that somehow we have to protect people from dying. But they die. We all will. And
But I was just going to say, Kate, I'm sure with your experience as a nurse, and it's the same for me as a police officer, is when something like that does happen and someone dies or someone gets worse, the second guessing starts, you know, immediately. I could have done this. What if I would have done that? I should have seen that earlier. And then you start feeling guilty for this other person's death. And that just kind of feeds into being depressed. And it's really terrible because there's not a whole lot of training out there, which is the main reason I wrote the book, to teach us how to deal with that stuff. I mean, if we just focus on what we can control, which is how hard we work, the level of compassion and commitment we put into our work, our level of dedication, how we react to things, and just leave everything else up to, you know, God and what is going to happen. If we can just do our very, very best and then walk away, that's going to help us tremendously to not get into that pattern of always second-guessing and doubting what we did.
Because it's ingrained in us so much to prevent the demise of the people we're taking care of. You know, basically, that's what it comes down to. But Dan, we're coming to the end of this program. I have enjoyed talking with you. I really appreciate the work that you've done, and I'm so happy by the way you've raised the consciousness through what, you know, how much suffering does take place, but how the remedies that you put forth in your book for preventing the suffering and the post-traumatic stress is just, I have recommended the book now for the last month, and I will continue to do so. So thank you so much.
I appreciate it very much, Kate. I really enjoyed myself. Thank you.
Thank you, and have a wonderful evening with your family, I hope.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.